to the Naval Academy Museum Warrior Riders Podcast. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. In this 14-part series, we'll take you decade by decade, starting with the 1870s, discussing the significant naval events and developments that helped shape the U.S. Navy to coincide with the Naval Academy Museum exhibit, Warrior Riders, the U.S. Naval Institute, open from September 10, 2015 through January 31, 2016. Our guest for each episode leading us through the decades will be Naval Academy History Professor Emeritus and noted Naval Historian Dr. Craig Simmons and Naval Academy Museum Director Claude Barabé. There's a big gap in the popular knowledge of the influence of and the developments in the U.S. Navy from the U.S. Civil War to the Spanish-American War. But there was a tremendous story to be told between the Battle of Hampton Roads between the USS Monitor and the CSS Virginia and the destruction of the Spanish fleets in Cuba and the Philippines. And as the dust settles on our Civil War, and this is where I think we want to start to tell our story decade by decade, beginning with this interwar period and then moving beyond it. And the first part of that, to kick off all our story, is with the 1870s. And Craig, when we look at the 1870s, in what way did you see the shadow of the recently finished U.S. Civil War affect the U.S. Navy during this time period?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's very pertinent to what happened to the Navy during this period that many historians refer to as a period of retrenchment, or to use a nautical term, the doldrums. It's characteristic of the United States Navy that it tends to enter wars underprepared and exit from them with this giant fleet that's been developed in wartime for that particular purpose, and then somehow let the fleet dissipate. There are those who criticize this policy as frankly no policy at all, but this is a classic case of that. The United States went into the Civil War with a Navy of only 42 active service ships, most of those on distant station patrol, and left the war in 1865 with a fleet of 671 warships, and yet 5 years later there were only 52. Now, again, the criticism that's been laid upon Navy policymakers for allowing this apparent moment of pending greatness to slip away is a bit misguided, I think, because if we look at what happened to those 671 ships, 418 of those were converted merchant steamers who could not have stood hull to hull or even at great distance with a pirate ship, much less a warship of a European navy. So they were clearly temporary vessels for immediate service and were essentially sold off, scrapped, and mothballed. Then there were 100 more, give or take a handful, of river warships. Well, river warships for a nation interested in defending its coastal frontiers are of dubious utility, so most of those were put into ordinary, as they called it at the time, what we call mothballs today. And then there were the coastal monitors. They were arguably, at least, the most powerful ships of their day, but with a freeboard of between 4 and 12 inches, they really were not seagoing warships, and most of those were laid up. So once you subtract that from the 671, you see that the 52 or so ships that are left are probably about as many as the Navy could make effective use of in the 1870s. But nevertheless, the dominant thing that characterizes the decade at the end of the Civil War is the loss from active service of hundreds of ships that had fought in that war, and at the end of this period of doldrums, if you want to call it that, the Navy had returned to kind of a constabulary force for service on distant station overseas from China to Africa to the Mediterranean.
Was there any significant harmful fallout from the drawdown?
There may have been. There are moments in every nation's history when it's useful to have a fleet that, even if it doesn't go into active service, even if it doesn't fire its guns, can nevertheless have an impact on the attitudes of foreign powers. And one of those moments came probably in 1873, pretty much at the depth of this decline for the U.S. Navy. And that was when, during the interminable revolution that was going on in Cuba, some Americans and other foreign nationals chartered a ship to carry weapons into the Cuban rebels with whom they sympathized, fighting a war of independence against the Spanish Empire. The ship was the Virginius. It had been an American ship. It was commanded by an American citizen, in fact, a former naval officer and Naval Academy graduate named Joseph Fry. And the Spanish caught him, red-handed, unloading guns, preparing to unload guns to the revolutionaries, which in their view was a capital offense. And they took the crew ashore and after a quick trial condemned them all to death and was in the process of putting them against a wall and shooting them when a British warship said, if you don't stop doing that, we're going to open fire on the port of Santiago. So they did stop, but a number were killed, including a number of Americans. And, of course, Americans back home were upset by this. And in order to demonstrate the seriousness of our anger at this behavior, President Grant ordered a mobilization of the fleet at Key West. Well, what happened was that some of those old monitors and seagoing river craft had been laid up in ordinary now for 8 years or more. They were rusty, they were cranky, the engines wouldn't work on many of them, and it broke down on many of the others, and it really demonstrated that a president saying mobilize the fleet didn't really lead to a mobilization of the fleet. It was not quite a wake-up call because, of course, the United States was engaged in other things at the time, but it did demonstrate that not having an active fleet you could put quickly into service could be a detriment.
Well, with the fleet that they did have that could get underway and do their business, what did the U.S. Navy in the 1870s do with their reduced but operational fleet?
Well, for the most part, it returned to the kind of naval service that had characterized the 1840s and 1850s before the Civil War broke out. The Navy perceived of its role in the 19th century generally and well into the 20th century as a service that could protect American interests and particularly American maritime interests overseas. Now, these had varied from the beginning of the 19th century when piracy in the Caribbean or slave trading off the coast of Africa were two of the big issues that the Navy dealt with. But often this meant involving itself with small African states or Asian states who interfered with American merchantmen. Merchant ships who found themselves subject to bullying or unfair taxing or harassment or even open piracy required an American warship or two to come steaming up and get things back in the line. So those are the kinds of things the Navy did, although it had a detrimental effect on occasion. And I'll cite one interesting example of that in 1871 when Captain John Rogers of the Navy, who was the son of another Captain John Rogers who had fought in the War of 1812, so this is a Navy family, brother of Christopher Perry Rogers, who also fought in the Civil War. John Rogers was assigned to command a fleet of four U.S. Navy warships that would go to Korea and essentially do in Korea what Matthew Perry had done in Japan in 1853 and 54, and that is open the Hermit Kingdom to trade with Americans, sign a treaty, begin negotiations, and so on. And in pursuit of that, they carried an American diplomat named Lowe along with them. But when those four ships showed up off the coast of Korea, some trigger-happy Korean in one of the small forts fired a shot at one of the American ships, and well, the American ships fired back, and there was a brisk exchange of fire, which soon petered out, and then Rogers sent a message ashore saying, you must apologize, this is an insult to the American flag, and you must make amends. Well, the Koreans wouldn't do it. So Rogers assembled a landing force of about 560-580 men, a lot of blue jackets, 109 Marines, and sent them ashore, captured the forts, killed those defending the fort, killed something like 280 Koreans, took only 20 of them alive, spiked all the guns, took all their flags, and went back aboard ship Well, that'll show them. I mean, that upheld American honor, but it absolutely destroyed any chance of getting a treaty with Korea or opening negotiations, and so that was put on the side burner. So while American captains and American ships on these distant stations perceived that it was their mission to protect American mercantile interests, sometimes their enthusiasm for defending American honor undercut the mission of protecting or expanding American mercantile interests.
As we've often found in periods of challenge, there are also some really bright spots that come up. In this period, there were some bright spots that came up, one of which was the founding of the U.S. Naval Institute. How did that take place?
Well, that's interesting. I think what happened in the 1870s is because American naval officers and service enlisted men as well, but particularly career officers, I think, felt that society was kind of pushing them out of the bright light of public attention. I mean, they had been in the headlines during the Civil War. Once that ended and American interest shifted inward to the opening of the American West, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, telegraph lines extending to the Pacific coast, most of the public attention was inward, and naval officers felt that they'd been kind of put onto a back shelf. And to maintain their own professional edge, a group of them got together and decided, well, what we'll do is we'll meet once a month, and we'll discuss professional topics. We're each going to pick a topic, we're going to research it, we're going to come and discuss it and ask questions of one another. We are going to maintain our professional edge by making sure that we, at least, even if the country isn't paying attention, do pay attention to not only changing technology, which of course is in the midst of change in the 1870s, but how that technology affects strategy, the relationship of the Navy to the country, tactics to a certain extent, but also strategy. And they found that some of the members would come to these meetings and present essentially papers. And they thought, well, you know, these should get a wider distribution. So they began having these discussions in 1871. By 1873 or 74, they had decided that they would publish some of them. So they said, well, these conversations and these papers are the proceedings of our meetings, so we're going to publish something called the Naval Institute Proceedings, which began in the middle of the 1870s and, of course, became a regular publication and now is essentially the forum of the professional Navy in the United States. So it began in the 1870s, but I think it began precisely because the Navy was suffering kind of a difficult time, and officers wanted to make sure they weren't forgotten.
Especially in this time period, the services, the Navy was the one that encountered foreign nations and their developments and their thoughts more than almost any other. And were there some international developments in the other world's navies that influenced the U.S. Navy during this period?
Well, there certainly were developments in the navies, particularly of Europe. And Europe is the standard by which most American professional naval officers measured themselves. The difficulty was that what applied, particularly technologically, to the European navies was not necessarily applicable to the American experience. The United States is unique in a number of ways. People talk today about American exceptionalism, whatever that may be, but we certainly are different and exceptional in terms of the geography that connects us or doesn't connect us with the rest of the world. And in Europe, most of the ships who had become steam vessels by now, armored steam vessels firing shells from rifled gun barrels that could more or less accurately target a vessel 10, 15 miles away by the end of the 19th century. The United States was more reluctant to adopt and embrace steam, or for that matter, armor. The difficulty was for the Royal Navy, for example, the great navy of the 19th century, Victoria's Navy, her potential enemies were all within a couple of hours steaming time. The French, historically and traditionally, the Germans increasingly and in the future would be the nations that she would have to keep the sharpest eye on, and they were just across the English Channel or the North Sea. So England's Navy was largely a short-legged Navy. It did have an empire on which, as the saying goes, the sun never set, and that meant that ships often had to travel long distances. But on the other hand, they, because of that empire, they also had naval bases at Singapore and in South Africa and at Alexandria and near Suez and at Gibraltar and elsewhere where their ships could refuel, in those days recoal, so that they could remain short-legged and still be effective in terms of what the Royal Navy needed to achieve to support British national interests. Now, for the United States, this is not the case. You know, there are 3,000 miles separating either of the American coasts from any potential foe. Canada was a benign neighbor to the north. Mexico, not only benign, but also weak neighbor to the south, did not cause us any problems in the 1870s. So the result was American ships, to conduct their patrols on distant stations, had to be long-legged. And steam propulsion was so inefficient in those days before the triple expansion engine that to depend heavily on steam meant you could find yourself in the middle of the Atlantic, or even worse, the Pacific Ocean, needing to recoal and having no place you could go to do that. Some people said, well, we could use the British bases too, but Britain was conceived of at that time as our most likely foe. So obviously you can't depend on British bases to recoal if you're at war with Britain. And as a result, the United States stayed with navigation by sail power a lot longer than the European nations did. In fact, there were rules written down for officers in command on distant stations that anytime they lit off their boiler and began burning precious and expensive coal, they had to enter the reasons for it in red ink in the ship's log to justify any reason why they actually lit off the boiler. You know, a typhoon was coming or whatever it might be. Because otherwise they were expected to navigate by sail so they could conserve their coal for the truly desperate moments. So because of those differences between Europe's situation and America's situation, not all of the advances that took place in Europe were embraced by the Americans in the 1870s. And their critics, both at the time and later, said, well, that's just foolishness and backwardness on the American part. But actually, there was a pretty sound reason for doing it.
And you touched on a couple of items about the American exceptionalism in this time period. Of course, our geography is unique, special, and is a gift. But also in this period after the Civil War, that's when, as a nation, we started to look west to really fulfill what was described at the time as our manifest destiny and rush to the Pacific. And in addition to Japan and other areas in the far west, to start to look at that economically, how did that drive and that push to the Pacific and the West Coast and uniting our two coasts together, how did that influence the design and the strategy as our Navy as they progressed from 1870 to 1879?
Well, I mentioned already the design problem. I mean, you needed ships that had a steam boiler because you'd be hopelessly out of date if you didn't. And that the stern propeller, the screw propeller, as it was called at the time, rather than side paddle wheels, had pretty much demonstrated that it was vastly the superior technology for ships. But for American ships, which navigated often under sail, it was useful to put a hinge in the drive shaft to the propeller so you could lift that thing right up out of the water when you were under sail so that it didn't drag as ships progressed. So the design of ships changed because of this very different kind of interest in the United States, the different geographical circumstances. But I want to add to that, too, that one of the things the Navy struggled with in the 1870s and in the decades that followed, and that is still an issue, in fact is always an issue in terms of Navy planning, is budgeting. I mean, the Navy can do nothing unless Congress gives it the money to do it. And Congress in the 1870s was disinclined to come up with large amounts of money to build any new warships. I mean, good heavens, we had 670 of those, and we don't need any more now. So ship lives were extended. Ships who really reached their appropriate retirement moment in the mid-70s were extended into the mid-80s because Congress declined to come up with funding. And Congress, like the rest of the country, was focused on what was happening to the West. I mentioned the Transcontinental Railroad, the Golden Spike of which was hammered down in 1869. So in 1870, the trunk line exists, but there are additional lines, both north and south of it, and then side lines running in and out to it, so that railroad expansion and railroad construction and railroad shipping was a dominant economic interest of the 1870s and into the 1880s. And this, again, drew the attention of Congress with their hands on the purse strings toward issues internal to the United States rather than external to the United States. There were wars in the 1870s, the Franco-Prussian War of 1871, for example. There were wars elsewhere in Europe and in Asia, but they just did not seem to have anything to do with us. And Congress saw no reason to open its checkbook and give the Navy any more money. So ships were extended, the lifetime of ships, old technology was recycled, partly because of the different geographical circumstances, but partly, too, because Congress was in no mood to come up with the money.
You can walk on board any ship in the Navy, even our new construction ships, and if you take time to look around as you walk around, something becomes really apparent, and to kind of end up our conversation at the 1870s, Craig, is every decade has some type of technological or philosophical or operational development that has some stick-to-itiveness. It stays with the Navy. What are some things that a new seaman apprentice or even a new ensign walking across the quarterdeck for the first time, will they be working with in our Navy that if they pulled the thread on it long enough could trace its heritage back to the 1870s?
Oh, gosh, that's an interesting question. I think not only back to the 1870s, but even back to the Age of Sail, the idea of decorative rope work and brass and the ship's bell and some of the traditions, the ringing of the bells, two bells, four bells, six bells to mark the passing of time during the watches, all of these traditions began much prior to the current age, and there are folks today, I suppose, who find them a bit quaint when they think about the modern Navy, but they were all there. The bosun's whistle, these are things that were certainly present in the 1870s, helped to maintain that sense of professional unity and longevity, a link back to the past, to John Paul Jones, if you would, and a link forward as well, which allowed the Navy to maintain those traditions that have been with us for a long time.
Thank you, Craig, and I look forward to going over the 1880s with you next.
Thank you, Sal. It'll be fun.
Claude, as we start our podcast series with the 1870s, I thought this might be a good opportunity is just kind of set the scene to describe the purpose of this exhibit that we're building the podcast series around.
Certainly. Well, the mission of the United States Naval Academy Museum is to instill in midshipmen a sense of their heritage, to inform the general public about the Navy and Marine Corps history, and also to preserve and protect many of our naval artifacts. So with that in mind, we decided to do an exhibit on warrior writers and tell it through the tale of the United States Naval Institute. The Naval Institute presented an excellent medium for doing this because of its close association with the Naval Academy. Of course, it was founded in 1873 by a group of naval officers at the Academy, and from 1939 to 1999, it in fact shared office space with the museum, Preble Hall, at the Naval Academy, and USNI had actually contributed a lot of money to build it in 1939. So there's a very long history between the two organizations. So really, the first purpose is to really inspire midshipmen, all our 4,200 midshipmen in the brigade, to think and speak and write about their profession. They can offer a lot, even at a very young age, and that's why a number of the warrior writers in this exhibit are really junior officers, many who would go on to be Admiral King or Admiral Nimitz or General Greene, were at one time Lieutenant J.G. Nimitz writing for proceedings or Lieutenant Ernest J. King writing for proceedings, etc. So number one, it's to inspire the midshipmen to write about, think and write about their careers. Number two, it's to demonstrate to the general public in terms of our mission The role that the Naval Institute has had in national security discussions really since 1873. And third, it's to exhibit some of our items that we've never shown before. Keep in mind, the Naval Academy Museum has 58,000 artifacts, so we don't get to show all of them in our permanent exhibit. So we have rotating galleries as well. So this provided a good opportunity to show about 60% of this exhibit are things that we've never shown before. And a few from authors themselves and more from more recent years, as well as from the United States Naval Institute.
As Craig and I discussed earlier on in the podcast, is, and I think that that's a great thing about museums. It's one thing to read. It's another thing to see, and if you have the gloves on, to feel. And when you go through a lot of the older books, you can even smell history, how it's right there. And In 2015, that seaman apprentice or that ensign who's coming into work, is there's a history and a heritage that it isn't dry, it isn't stale. It affects how they work and serve on a day-to-day basis. And history has a way of highlighting those things. And what are some of the featured authors and artifacts from the 1870s that you at the museum have decided, you know, really needs to break above the background noise and to be presented?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head about some things being stale, because in some cases, that's what we had to work with. To put this exhibit together, we had to identify artifacts that belonged to or were donated by the warrior writers. In fact, there was one ordnance book from Lieutenant Edward Very that needed conservation desperately, as did a letter book by Commander Norman Farquhar, who was a commandant of the midshipmen. So this gave us an opportunity to send these out and to ensure that they would be preserved for future generations. Getting back to the very ordnance notes, I found it fascinating because people may have heard of Very because of one of his more famous patents. You're familiar with flare guns. Well, that is actually a Very gun that he designed and developed. So you see in his book, his ordnance books, how he is developing his thoughts. In a similar vein, Commander Farquhar's letter book is fascinating from the perspective of an officer going through his career in the mid to late 19th century. In fact, it's funny, as we were reading through some of these letters, he keeps telling people he doesn't want to go to the Naval Academy to be the commandant. And he has senior officers saying, no, you're going to the Naval Academy. And he said, no, I really want to go to sea. Well, he eventually does come to the Naval Academy. But it really puts a human perspective. And it reminds us that, you know, if you take the king's shilling, you do the king's work. And Farquhar did come to the Naval Academy and served admirably there. We also have displayed a decoration from King Victor Emmanuel III of Italy. It was presented to Admiral Goodrich, one of the founders of the Naval Academy. He had an interesting career. He had been Naval War College president from 1896 to 1898. He had been commander-in-chief of the Pacific Squadron, and had actually sailed his fleet to San Francisco to assist in firefighting efforts after the 1906 earthquake. So that decoration is mounted, and it's for being a grand officer of the Crown of Italy. Another item we have is the diploma of Theodorus Mason. Mason would later become the first head of the Office of Naval Intelligence. And what makes his diploma unique is that there are very few in existence. He had graduated at a time when there were only about 35 or 40 midshipmen graduating from the United States Naval Academy after the Civil War. As Craig mentioned, you know, we weren't building as many ships. We weren't graduating as many midshipmen as before. But what makes this interesting is that David Dixon Porter, our second admiral from the United States Navy, had signed this. He was the superintendent of midshipmen at the time. And he had changed the design of the diploma. Number one, he had a design of the Wabash ship during the Civil War placed on top of the diploma. But also, we think that he had done it on cheaper paper. So simply, there weren't as many from those years that were available under the David Dixon Porter years. Another item that we got from the United States Naval Institute is its first editorial board minutes book. And I think this was very important to show the thinking early on, not only in the Naval Institute, but how these officers were considering the papers and the articles that were being submitted to them. And as a former chair of the editorial board of proceedings, I would sometimes read through a couple of pages of this editorial book from the 1870s. And what I realized was that the same issues that we're dealing with in the Navy and Marine Corps today and the Coast Guard are the same issues that they were dealing in the 1870s. So those are just a few of the items that we have for that decade. Of course, we also have portraits of Stephen B. Luce and Alfred Thayer Mahan, who were also very instrumental early on as officers. And I think that time period of junior officers getting together, identifying problems, is not necessarily unique. It happened in the 1830s with Matthew Perry and other officers who were at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and they established the Naval Lyceum. And the Naval Lyceum was part library, part lecture hall, part museum. But in 1835 and 36, 37, they started writing articles. It was the very first time that there was a collection of articles by naval officers for naval officers that began to get greater readership. Even literary figures like James Fenimore Cooper would contribute to the Naval magazine. And today we see a group of junior officers in recent years having established SIMSEC, a think tank in D.C., to see what are the problems that the Navy and Marine Corps are going to have in the 21st century. So there's a wonderful tradition of junior officers collaborating, thinking, not necessarily having the same mindset, but at least discussing these issues to see where the path will lead them.
Well, Claude, I really appreciate the opportunity here today as we kick off our podcast series for the Warrior Riders. And for our next podcast, we're going to dive right into the heart of the steampunk era, the 1880s, and look forward to talking to you then.
Great. Thank you.